It's kind of embarrassing when you're introduced and you've been introduced as been in the order for a long time. I'm old, 63, and yes, I've been a practicing Buddhist for nearly 40 years, actually, so it's quite some time. One of my bad habits is when I give talks, I have so many things I want to say, and I have this reluctance to put it down on paper. So I left it until just a little while ago, and I got it down. That there it is. There's my talk. And I thought, I don't know if I'd be able to find my way around that mind map, so then I printed it out and only just got here on time. And so, yeah, it's a colourful schema. And I suppose I'd just like to say that when I, just to sort of get into the talk, when I was first interested in Buddhism, it came about because, I guess I was just looking for some meaning in life. I was talking to someone downstairs just now about how I didn't tell them how I became a Buddhist, but we just realised we shared something in common, that we just became vegetarians and stopped eating meat. And that's what I did. I don't know why exactly now. It just seemed like the right thing to do. And once I became a vegetarian, I found eating meat and other animals, fish and so on, difficult. I kept thinking of them, you know, had a lamb chop and I think of lambs, and have a bacon sandwich and I think of Babes. Is that the film? And so I just couldn't eat meat after that. And so when I became a vegetarian, I might have been looking for a reason to be a vegetarian. Maybe that's what led me to Buddhism. You know, I thought, oh, well, I could become a Buddhist and I could tell everyone I'm a vegetarian because I'm a Buddhist. Well, actually, a lot of Buddhists aren't vegetarians. It's a bit strange. So when I started getting interested in Buddhism, I found that it had a sort of a mystical, magical side, which really fascinated me. And I read lots of books about Tibetan Buddhism because it was all sort of very colourful and different. I grew up in London, in sort of working class area. Life was very boring, and I just like that, you know, sort of foreign, magical sort of side. And so I used to be very interested in Tibetan Buddhism, and done quite a lot of study of Buddhism. And I was talking to an acquaintance last weekend who was in Manchester visiting because he went to the Dalai Lama's workshops. And he got talking to me about the philosophy of Buddhism, and I noticed, an apology if he ever sees this talk, is that I sort of became a bit disengaged when he started talking about the philosophy, you know, some complicated side of Buddhism, because I've noticed over the years that my approach to Buddhism has just been to simplify the Buddha's message. And I nowadays think of it as sensible Buddhism, not magical, not sort of spiritual even, but just sensible Buddhism. The sort of no reason why anyone shouldn't be a Buddhist, because first of all, you don't have to believe in anything, and secondly, it just sort of like appeals to common sense. And so why wouldn't you do it? You might have to be a vegetarian, because you'll keep seeing sheep and pigs, and put you off eating them. And you know how it is, a lot of people, they don't even know that meat comes from animals. Do you know that? You know, a friend of mine, he was working in Salford with a group of young offenders, I think, and he took them away into the wilderness, and they were talking about, you know, sausages and bacon. And he said, well, do you know where they come from? And they thought, well, they're made in factories. And they hadn't sort of quite clocked, actually, they were, you know, parts of the flesh of animals. So sort of shows you in a way how unaware we are in the world, that we don't often ask questions about things. But I suspect all of you who've come today are here because you have asked a question of some sort. I mean, hopefully it wasn't, it's raining or likely to be raining on Saturday. What's going on in Manchester? Nothing. Oh, there's a talk at the Buddhist Centre. Let's go to that. I hope it wasn't the lowest on your list. But even if it was, never mind. You're very welcome. You know, one's got to put up with the weather. Summer. And football. You know, people need to stay at home to prepare to watch football as well. So I'll get on with the talk now. This is actually the third in a series of talks, but you don't need to have been to the previous ones to understand what I'm going to talk about today. But if you're interested, you can watch the other two talks on the internet. They're on the Manchester Buddhist Centre's website, and I can't tell you where they are, but they're there, and you can stream them down and watch them on your computer. But in the first talk, I suggested that when people come to the Buddhist Centre, they come here looking for something. And what the Tri Ratna Buddhist community, Buddhist order does, is to invite people to go on a journey. And when I was just driving here, I just was thinking about yesterday. You know, yesterday was raining a lot. And I was standing at a bus stop in Lower Broughton in Salford, and just looking. Fortunately, I was out of the rain. I was in a shelter and the cars weren't splashing me too much. And I was just sort of finding it all interesting. You know, it was all, everywhere was flooding. And I thought, this must be a floodplain. There's a river just over there. I wonder if it was... I was just thinking like that. And then this young guy went by. He wasn't about that high. He must have been about 14. And I suppose what those of you who live in Manchester might know as a scully, you know, is a sort of like... I wonder where my wallet was, and just sort of, you know, moved it around. But he came up, you know, sort of steaming up, stopped for a minute, and he swore. He didn't swear at me, he just swore. And he just went like this and walked on. And I suddenly felt, poor kid. You know, it just like his whole body language was one of fear, tightness and irritation and anger. You know, just used the F word. And he just sort of had this... feeling of just being so tight and narrow. And when I was driving here for this talk just a little while ago, I was thinking about him, and I was thinking about this journey. And I like to think the journey one's invited on is one that starts off perhaps in a very tight, dark place where things aren't so sort of clear, where you maybe experience the tightness in terms of fear, anxiety and meaninglessness. And the journey takes you, if you participate in it, along a path that gradually broadens out and becomes a bit more brighter, becomes a little brighter and more light shining in. And you start, your whole sort of perspective and vision starts broadening out, and you start seeing life in a different way. And this journey is all about really the transformation of mind. It's the way we see things. If we look at Lower Broughton, those of you who know it, in Salford, on a rainy, wet day, you could think it's the last place you want to be on earth. But I was quite enjoying it, actually. I was sort of thinking it's quite nice being here, you know, just looking at all this rain. And my perspective was certainly very different from that young guy's. I don't know what had happened to him. Maybe he had an argument with someone, or I don't know. But he did have this sort of feeling of being very, very tight. So in that first talk, I said that Buddhism is really like participating in a journey. And we participate in that journey because of some impulse. It may be a question. Increasingly, I think people are finding life less and less meaningful. You know, we have more or less the things we need to survive. But once we got them, so what? What do we do next? You know, naturally one starts asking questions. And sometimes in life it just seems as though something's missing. That was certainly my experience even as a child, that there was just something not quite right, something missing. And that persisted quite a long time through my life. But some years ago, quite a lot of years ago, it just disappeared, and I felt as though, you know, my life had meaning, and there was a sense of contentment to it. So I knew what I was doing and why I was doing it, although I wouldn't like to try and put it into words. I also said quite a bit about the view of Buddhism and the view of the Buddha has of the universe, and just to remind us that we live in a universe which is rather strange. For a start, we got no idea how it began. Even if we started off with a big bang, we don't really understand that. And we don't understand things like gravity. You know, why is there gravity? We know what gravity does, but we don't understand why it's there or even how it came to be. And there are a lot of regularities in the universe like that, gravity just being one of them. There's the law of thermodynamics, there's all sorts of laws and regularities in the realms of physics, in the realms of biology, in the realms of psychology. And this is all quite normal, and we don't usually think about it very much, but it's quite strange when you think about it. You know, regularities, you know, laws that things fall down when you drop them. You just take it all so for granted. You don't really need to think about it, and you can use those laws to, you know, make aeroplanes and fly around the world and develop medicines to cure the illnesses and so on, and even develop mind training techniques to work with things like depression. And all those things are quite, as it were, scientifically based. You know, we sort of think, well, science knows all about that, they're just how things are. But if you start asking how science came about and, you know, what's behind science and things, and you even ask scientists, do you know really, you know, absolutely what the truth is? And they all have to admit they don't. You know, like, you know what energy does, but you don't really know what it is. It's very difficult to even conceive of that. So life, it starts becoming more and more mysterious. When I encountered Buddhism, it became even more mysterious because there seemed to be two more regularities I was introduced to, which are, if you like, non-scientific. And I mentioned these in my last two talks, and we're going to talk a bit more about them today. One is what's called karma, and the other one is what's called a dharma. And they are regularities that karma is a sort of a moral regularity that... maybe I'll leave that and come back to it because it's going to be the main subject of my talk. But I just take it, there are these two other regularities that we consider as Buddhists. In the second talk, I mentioned these regularities again, and I said that one of the ways in which we see the world is because we have views, and our views about things are what define us in many respects. So if we want to make a journey, we actually have to go through a process of transforming ourselves. And in the Triratna Buddhist order, one of the ways in which we're beginning to define ourselves is by presenting Buddhism as having five main stages. I mean, lots and lots of different techniques and practices, but you could categorize them under one or another of these stages. And their stages are the stage of integration, where you bring together all the disparate parts of yourself, so the different parts of, you know, I mentioned it's a bit like having a number of selves, and someone was just reminding me at tea, you know, if you say, do you want to go out tonight? And the part of you says, oh, yeah, that'd be nice. Another part says, oh, I think I want to stand and watch football. And another part says, oh, it's going to rain. And then you think, no, but it'd be so exciting. And then you realise there's quite a few parts. And a friend of mine once said he often has to have a community meeting and get all these parts together and just check out, you know, what the majority wanted to do and go with that, because it usually works out right. Although sometimes the other parts say, I told you so, it wasn't going to be any good. And... So you often experience ourselves as slightly unintegrated, and we have to bring those different parts together. So that's an important aspect in the first stage. Of course, before you can do that, you have to become aware of yourself. You have to know that's what you're like, and you've got these different parts, these different interests, and there's nothing wrong with them. You just accept where you are, and then you start thinking, how can you work with that? Then the second stage is that you, well, the stage of what we call positive emotion or skillful intention, And this will need a little bit more unpacking, but it's basically the urge to become less self-focused, so less sort of concerned with yourself and more concerned with other people. Not that you forget about yourself, but you've been so concerned about yourself for so long, you think, well, that's enough of that. I've looked after myself now, and now I can take myself out and expand out to other people. And that's what you could call positive emotion, is that sort of change in orientation from being very self-centered to being other-regarding. Then there's a stage that needs you to sort of open up to the possibility of something more. So it's a bit like thinking, well, is this it? Is this life? You know, and when you're young, you're just too busy doing everything, isn't it? You don't sort of think about it too much. But, you know, I'm 63 now, and I sometimes think, if I was young again, I might have checked out a bit earlier, because if it didn't have any meaning, what would be the point? It's not like it's full of fun all the time. It's full of difficulties and problems with a bit of fun thrown in, because it's not all suffering. And I have to say, my life has been full of pleasant things, and I tend to look at the pleasant things when I look back on life. But when I are really truthful and I see those pleasant things in the context of all the difficulties, I sometimes think, wow, was it really worth it? You know, because it could have ended it a lot earlier and got it over with, and that's what's awaiting all of us. So what makes life, I think, worth living is the fact that actually seems something more to life than just the normal presentation of what you get in the papers, from society, particularly from our materialistic consumer sort of way of life these days. So one can open oneself to the possibility of what we call the Dharma, something more. And again, I'm going to go into this a bit more in my talk. Then there's a stage of what we can call spiritual death. It's not a great term, spiritual death, but it's sort of, if you, because it's unusual, it gets you to think about it. But in that talk, I suggested that many of us were so identified with our views and have so much emotion attached to our views that giving up some of our views would be like dying. You know, I did this on a retreat the other day. I was trying to get everyone to stand up and tell me what their view about rebirth was, right? And I got all the people that believed in it stand at one end of the room, and the people that didn't believe in it at the other end of the room, ones who weren't sure in the middle somewhere. And there weren't that many, actually, because it was a Buddhist retreat, who were down the really didn't believe in it end, and there was a lot in the middle and quite a lot at the other end. And I realised it wasn't quite working, this technique. And afterwards, I realised, if I'd asked these people, and they were quite a lot of young people, what their views, you know, do you think it's necessary to recycle bottles? Because I don't. Because I could have said that, you know, just to provoke them. And I could have been an antagonist, you know. And I could guarantee you there, the hackles would have gone up, the shoulders would have gone up, and people would have tightened and said, how dare you say that? And people had very, very strong views about things like recycling. And so if you can imagine yourself, have you got any views that you would be really hard pushed to let go of? I mean, it might be good views and useful views that you feel passionate about, but you know, if someone was to prove to you that actually wasn't particularly useful, how would you feel about it? Or if you got into an argument with someone, do you ever get into arguments with people? You know, like someone says, that's not fair, and you say, so what? You know, I don't believe in fairness. And, you know, fair is a view, not fair, I don't care, is a view. You've just got two views sort of locked into. So spiritual death could be about giving up certain views that you're very attached to. When you do that, you have a sort of breakthrough. It's like a rebirth, and that's the fifth stage. It's called spiritual rebirth. Is that you become a different person because you've just let go of who you were and you become new. So it's a sort of like you've become a new being. Not totally new, but you've been transformed in some way. So it's like a rebirth. So the five stages are integration, positive emotion, receptivity, spiritual. Use the word spiritual for something higher. And spiritual death and spiritual rebirth. And Radical change would be to, for instance, letting go of use, to start seeing the world in a slightly different way. And I talked a little bit about the difference between what you could call useful views or right views and unhelpful views or what you could call wrong views, and that one does need to adopt certain views because you have to have views, but you also need to learn how to hang kind of loose a little bit to some of the views that we have. So this talks about the Buddha in the world today. You know, when people ask you to give a talk, actually I suggested I gave a talk, but I didn't really know what I wanted to talk about. And I've got the sort of mind that could talk about a lot of things. And so I have to give a sort of quite a generic title that would allow me to talk about anything I felt passionate about this week. And so I've got to make sure I talk to you about the Buddha today. And I'll try to weave that in at the end and just tell you about the things I'm interested in at the moment, which actually does include that. So, just going back to this word karma, karma just means, it's an Indian word, just means actions really, but in this context it means moral actions. So we have what we could call, what we often call in Buddhism, skillful, what we call in the Triratna community, skillful and unskillful actions. So it's everything that is helpful to move you along this journey. So the things that are skillful are what would help you to move forward on this journey through this tunnel out to a sort of brighter perspective. And what we would call unskillful would be the things that stopped you, would even slightly hold you back or move you back backwards. So there's a sort of a moral issue concerned with this. And it's not just actions, but actions include thoughts, because any action, any physical action that you take, has behind it some sort of thought. And actually behind that, there's a view. So often there's an emotion, but the emotion's attached to a view very often, if you start analysing what really goes on in our minds. And what the Buddha taught was that what will help you on this journey are actions, thoughts, and even speech that is kindly, caring, honest, and so forth, generous. It's more to do with other people. It's not just being honest with yourself, caring about yourself, and being generous to yourself. It's actually about opening that out to include other people. So if you have thoughts that are kindly to others, generous to others, and truthful to others, then these would be skillful thoughts. And incidentally, others sort of includes you. So it's not like you have to be a martyr and not think about you, but you just think about you as part of others. And so you're not just so self-centered, but you are not also self-deprecating and pushing yourself away, but you know, you include yourself. So that's the basis of Buddhist morality. And so, you know, do you believe it? Do you even know what to believe? You know, if someone tells you this is what the Buddha said, you might think, oh, it sounds reasonable. And but how do you know what you should believe or not? And I was having this conversation with this acquaintance last week who's Buddhist, and I just reminded him that there is actually a story, a sutta, is what one of the things the Buddha said, where he told the monks or the people who were practicing spiritual life at that time how they could work out what was going to be useful to them and what was going to be not useful to them. There was lots of, in India, 2,500 years ago, at the time of the Buddha, there were lots of people practicing the spiritual life, lots and lots of views, lots of opinions, lots of traditions, lots of scriptures, lots of analogies, and etc. And people didn't know which was true. Some people said there was a soul, and some people said, no, there is no soul. Some people said there's a God, and others said, no, there is no God. And a lot of the monks just felt quite confused, and they went and asked the Buddha what he thought. these people were called the Kalamas, and he said, don't go by reports, by legends, by traditions, by scripture, by local conjecture, by inference, by analogies, by agreement, through pondering views, by probability, or by thought. He said, when you know yourself that qualities are skillful, these qualities are blameworthy, these qualities are unskillful, these qualities are blameworthy, these qualities are criticized by the wise, these qualities are adopted and carried out, lead to harm and to suffering, then you should abandon them. He also said, when you know for yourself that these qualities are skillful, these qualities are blameless, these qualities are praised by the wise, these qualities, when adopted and carried out, lead to welfare and happiness, then you should enter and remain in them. So his message was basically, trust yourself. You know, what you think, what you decide is the right, you sort of know is what the right. It's that you actually know what is good, so to speak, and bad. Sometimes you do things which you feel bound to do because everyone else is doing them. But a little part of you tells you, this isn't right. Have you ever had that feeling? You know, where you've been somewhere and someone's encouraging you to sort of just participate in the group activity and you're really not comfortable with it, but you go along with it and you don't always feel good about yourself afterwards. But you there's part of you saying, this isn't right. I don't really want to do this. But you do it anyway. Well, sometimes you don't do it. But what the point is that you know, don't you? And also, when you're doing certain actions, you know that was a good action. That made me feel proud. That made me feel good about myself. And people usually are praising you, and particularly people you respect a bit more. So the Buddha's advice to us was that we don't need to actually believe others. We actually just go by our real inner experiences. We have to sort of be careful that we're not giving into group mentalities. So just to be part of the group, we're doing just doing what the group says. But we've got enough awareness to know that actually we do know. We can trust ourselves. And this is a good thing to do, and this isn't such a good thing to do. And we can always discuss these things with others. We can, you know, just try and broaden out our perspective on that. So karma is really working with what we know to be morally skillful, ethically skillful. It's what we know to be right. And what happens is that when we start using our minds in a more integrated way, we become more aware and our life begins to change, then we notice that we actually become different. We actually notice we sort of become a bit more transformed. We spend all our time just thinking about ourselves, just having thoughts about, you know, what we want, which we all do. It's quite normal and natural. But if we spend, you know, all our time doing that, and what we often find is our life becomes a bit narrow, and we feel a bit disconnected to people. It's, 63 years old now. I grew up in London, in a working class area, and it wasn't an area where you left your doors unlocked. But I've noticed over the years how security conscious I've been. I mean, my parents drummed it into me, like, you know, if you leave anything out, someone will take it, sort of thing. So, I have sort of noticed how security conscious I've become, that I worry about things like, oh, just moved into a new flat in Salford, and I just think, I haven't got any any insurance. And I'm thinking, do I need it? And I'm thinking, well, likelihood of someone breaking in is, well, it's not unlikely, but, you know, it's sort of a relatively secure place where I live. But I was thinking, oh, I ought to get contents insurance. And I was thinking, why? And I thought, well, supposing I lost everything. So what? I haven't got very much actually to lose, so it wouldn't make an awful lot of difference to me. And but I noticed actually it was just the thought I had that I ought to have contents. Like any sensible person has to have insurance. And You know, I do that with a car. You know, I think, oh, I must insure the car because, you know, well, you have to because it's law, actually. So, you know, but, you know, you have a choice between comprehensive and third party. And you always, I always sort of think, oh, I better do it for the full amount because, you know, something might happen. And, you know, things do happen. And it's usually insensible to take out certain types of insurance. But the point was, I'm sort of going around just becoming more and more aware now of how fearful we are about having things stolen. Well, I am. And I don't remember this so much when I was younger. And I certainly, when I lived in the country, it was such a relief not to have to worry about these things. You know? And certainly, because when I lived in the country, I lived in the houses of communities. And there was a lot of people there, so you never locked the doors. And it was a really nice feeling. No alarms, no doors to lock. You just sort of wandered in and out, and no one else did. Just the community. And, you know, there was no one breaking in, usually. And it was just made me aware of how tight life becomes when you're a bit frightened. That's what it comes down to, isn't it? You're basically frightened of losing something. It's not going to kill you if you lose all your contents. It's going to be probably really irritating and cause a number of problems, but it's not going to harm you. You know, if you lose all the things you're attached to, you're not going to die. I mean, you might be upset, you know, if you lose your photographs and things, like someone's house is burgled. People usually feel violated, but no one's done anything to you. They've just gone into your house, into your space, I suppose. So we often have this sort of tightness and fear about our possession. It's quite natural and normal, nothing wrong with it. But imagine what it would be like if you weren't like that. You know, if you took sensible precautions, like you locked your door and window, shut your windows, and lock those, and so on, but you weren't really that worried, you know, because you've got all the insurance. But, you know, when you've got all the insurance, you're still a bit worried, aren't you? But imagine if you weren't worried, like you think, well, it doesn't matter, really. I'm going to die someday, it's all going to go. I mean, I'm not going to take it with me, so, you know, I could just let go of it now. Just imagine if you didn't have to worry about death. You didn't have to worry about getting old or getting ill. You know, just could just be now, just present, and just feel connected to things. It would have perhaps a very, very different aspect to the world. So working with karma, allowing our thoughts to be more skillful, is probably a very, very good thing. Just one little problem with it, and that is you have to make an effort. You won't naturally do it. You will on occasions, you will naturally be kind and generous, but usually you won't. Usually you'll be a bit self-centered. Why? Because that's the world we live in. The world we live in tells us if we don't have this and this and this, we'll suffer. If you buy a mobile phone, right, and it's a bit dodgy saying this to Buddhists because they usually have quite old models of mobile phones. But a lot of my friends who, you know, people I work with and people who come to our courses, they seem to have the latest mobile phone. You know, if it's not the iPhone, it's the iPhone 2S. And now it's the iPhone 4, I think, and there's probably another one. And you know they're designed to come out just when you start getting a little bit bored with them. And you've usually got this feeling that if you haven't got the latest one, there's something wrong. You're not going to be so happy. So what do? You wait for, you know, it's a 2-year contract. They've worked out 2 years is about the maximum. Right? After 2 years, you usually want a new model. Right? And so you can get the new model. You know, like last sort of 3 months, you think, oh, I've got to get the new model. 3 months, I've only got 3 months to go on the contract. And we live our lives very often affected by advertising and the consumer society that we work in, because it wouldn't work if we weren't buying new mobile phones, if we weren't constantly buying, then our society wouldn't function properly. But it's having a big effect on us. It's making us more and more self-centered and thinking about, you know, me. If we really believed that mobile phones were going to make people happy, we would be buying them for other people, wouldn't we? We'd be thinking, oh, I've just got you a 2-year contract. Don't worry about paying for it. I'll cover that. It's the latest phone. This will make you happy. If you really thought it would, and sometimes it makes people happy for a short time, but then usually they, you know, I got a new phone this year, smartphone. I was thinking, living in Salford, it's more of a problem. You know, I had a little flip phone that was quite old in my pocket. I never worried about it being stolen. But now I've got a smartphone, and I'm thinking, which pocket have I got that in? And that's what people want to steal. And so you actually create more problems sometimes and makes your life a bit tighter. So karma is something you can work on and you need to work on, but it's not easy. We have habits and it needs a constant reflection and constant help to do that. There's also what we could call the Dharma. This is this strange, something that's very, very difficult to talk about, but it's as though there is this urge to find more meaning in life. And maybe that's why you're here. I think everyone's had some experience of it. I doubt very much if there's anyone here. Maybe some people are just a bit inquisitive, but then why are you inquisitive? It's because there's perhaps some sort of regularity in the universe that's just affecting us, that we actually feel we haven't quite got it. There's something more. There's something missing, and we're sort of looking for it. Of course, a lot of people don't allow themselves to open up to that experience, except perhaps at times of great sadness or loss or faced with death or something like that. But it does seem to be a sort of, it's difficult to talk about. It's as though, it's a bit like gravity almost, as though something sort of attracting us or moving us in a certain direction. You could say it's just evolution, it's just to survive, but if it was just to survive, is it really worth it? You know, it's sort of, you don't need to do very much today, and eventually you'll die, you know, within the next 100 years, less. But you don't need to do very much, but it does seem as though there is something sort of moving us on. So Buddhism is really about working with this power of karma. It's about dwelling on other people, dwelling on other people's needs, taking yourself into consideration, but broadening yourself out and noticing how this is transforming you. That each day, each may not seem like it each day, but maybe each year, you begin to realize that you're different, you've changed. You've let go and you've become a bit more orientated in a broader perspective. You start feeling more connected. You're more connected with the world. You feel more connected with how things are. When you start seeing how things are, one of the things you notice is everything's changing. Nothing stays the same. You can't nail anything down and expect it to be there in a completely the same state within a few hours even. You know, even the light of it. You know, if you see a mountain constantly changing light, if you see it in the dark, you can't see it. So, paradox that, but it's you know it's there, but it looks different. And some on a rainy day it might be very uninviting, and on a sunny day it's very inviting. So it's always changing. Everything's changing, and it's very difficult to feel secure in a world where everything's changing, isn't it? Because you think you've got your home with all your contents. We're on that subject, and they're all going to be there, but someone's going to be robbed. There's a statistic. I don't know what it is, but one in so many is going to be robbed today, and it could be you. Could be me. Did I lock the door? I set the alarm. And why shouldn't it be me? You know, if it's one in 15 or one in 20, why shouldn't I be the person that's robbed? You know, you just think, well, you know, it's just how it is. Everything's changing. I thought I was going to go home to a nice, secure flat, but maybe it won't be. Maybe it'll be just trashed, you know, and my day will be different to how I imagined it to be. Imagine if you can live with that flow, you know, that things are changing. You just think, oh, well, you know, if I went home and my flat was trashed, that'd be a challenge, you know, could refurnish it. First of all, I'd have to find some money, though, because I haven't got insurance. And at least I haven't got the bother of negotiating with insurance companies. And so that's a win. And anyway, I could have it zen-like. You know, I could just get rid of everything and just sit on the floor. And you know, that could be good, it'd be cool. I could have a new design in there. And you start seeing things in a slightly positive way. And that would be more the sort of attitude that you would have if you went with flow, if you just think, okay, things are changing. You know, relationships, you're not getting on with someone. If you're like me, I usually think, oh, good, who can I go out with next? Actually, I don't, but, you know, the thought does pass through my mind. And you look at, you know, people, you think, oh, that person could be quite nice. And then you think, then you reflect on it, you think, oh, well, I'd probably be back in the same place because things seem to go round in circles and probably more to do with me than other people, why relationships go as they do. Anyway, I'm in a very lovely relationship, but I did actually, just talking on that theme, have a dream one night where I woke up and I thought, what would happen if my partner died? And it really frightened me. And I realised how attached I was to her and how my life was built around our relationship. And I just thought, God, I wouldn't know what to do. That was the first thought I had. And then I sort of got a bit more positive and I thought, oh, well, you know, you'd have to move on, wouldn't you? And thinking, you know, well, what are the benefits? And I sort of, you know, I realised that, well, I wasn't going to die. And there's, you know, out of difficulties always comes something new. So I suddenly let go of the whole thing and stopped worrying about it and carried on loving her. So it was fine. But making an effort to practice being morally skillful, practicing karma, working on our mind, isn't easy because it is. There's a big part of us just wants to take the easy way out, isn't there? And it's a bit like I'm reading a book called Thinking Fast and Slow. When you ask people what is 2 times 2. What is it? Was that easy?
Yeah.
Yeah, didn't need to think. Okay, since you like multiplying, what is 17 times 24? Did you notice you didn't want to do that?
Yeah.
Well, practice of karma is a bit like 24 times 17. I'm sorry to say. It's not always going to be 2 times 2. It's a bit like you think, this is a good talk, 2 times 2. Yeah, I'm up for this. I'm just going to go home and practice being generous to other people. But actually, it's not like that. It's a bit more like multiplying 24 by 17. It requires a decision that you're going to do it. That would be the first thing. If I said, okay, I'm going to give you 17 times 24,000 pounds... Right, you'd probably be a bit more motivated to work that out, wouldn't you? You'd be getting your paper out if you couldn't do it in your mind. But so you would have to make an effort and you'd have to be convinced. You'd need some sort of motivation, probably, because why would you multiply 17 by 24 unless you just happen to be that sort of strange sort of person and like doing that sort of thing. So you need to make this effort. You need to make an effort to be aware that there is something moving you on and you won't feel satisfied unless you go with it. You'll probably constantly feel there's something wrong in life. And well, how do you make that effort? Well, I've come to the conclusion I can't do it on my own. It's the first time in my life I've actually lived in a flat on my own. I've owned a house before, but I've owned that with other people. It's really nice going home to your own flat because you don't have to negotiate anything, you know, complete autonomy, as long as you don't upset the neighbours. And, you know, I can eat when I want, do what I sort of want in the flat and watch TV if I want or watch football when I want and things like that. But also, there's very little stimulation. And I'm an extrovert, so I like to get my stimulation from the world around me. So I quite like having discussions with people. In fact, I'm even slightly... I often see arguing as a sort of sport. You know, like I like to say I don't believe in recycling just to get someone to have a discussion about, you know, how important it is. And then I like to point out all the faults in their argument. And it's all quite fun, really. But, you know, when you're talking about Buddhism and what you could do if more and more people in the world became Buddhist, it becomes sort of inspiring for me and stimulating. And Indri Ratna Buddhist movement, our teacher, Sangrakshita, he said that something strange seems to happen when you've got people together who are really making an effort to transform themselves. Something new seems to emerge that you can't really explain. He said it, the only way he could sort of really talk about it is if any of you, he gave the example of playing in an orchestra or a band, I suppose, or singing in a choir. I don't know if any of you have done anything like that, but if you have, and I've done a little bit of it, what I experienced on some occasions is that something seems to happen that is more than the sum of the parts. You know, it's a bit like you suddenly have an experience, you're quite aware of yourself, and you're aware of other people and what you're singing and things like that, but it's difficult to explain. It's a sort of an experience of something that's more than just these parts that are going on. You're carried away by something, and it's a wonderful, uplifting experience when you have it. And I've had this working with people as Buddhist, doing things that I felt were very, very skillful, doing the sort of work I do at Breathworks, which is helping people that are suffering. I find that extremely rewarding, particularly when I'm working with a team of people and we do things in groups. And it's as though I'm not there. It's as though I'm not that important. And I just become part of something bigger. And he says, perhaps you could describe this as a sort of like a third level of consciousness. That we have what you could call the group consciousness, where people aren't really perhaps individuals at all. They're just a sort of statistical individual. They just do what the group does and don't think about it. You get an individual who's emerging from the group, who's thinking, why am I doing this? You know, why am I eating meat, for instance? And why am I doing these actions? And that you could call an individual. And they're not so influenced by the group, even though we all have to be part of groups. And then you get this third level of consciousness, which is like where you are an individual, but you're networked with others. You're joined somehow with others in some mysterious way, where you experience another kind of consciousness, a sort of third level of consciousness. So what's this all got to do with the Buddha in the world today? which is what I was going to talk about, wasn't it? Well, basically, in order for us to transform ourselves skillfully, we need to do it in a world. It's not something you're going to do in your flat. And then, if you locked yourself away in your flat or your house or an equivalent of a cave and just worked on yourself, you might do it, but you wouldn't have much stimulation and you wouldn't have this experience probably of a third level of consciousness to keep you going. You really need other people. You need to be working with other people. And it's a friend of mine recently said in the talk that in a way, as a Buddhist, you don't have any option but to try to transform the world. Basically, if we don't change the world will change us. That's the sort of option. But it's a bit more complicated than that for Buddhists. It's more of a win-win situation. It's a bit like if you want to make an effort to transform yourself, you're going to need other people to help you, people around you who are making the same effort. Because, you know, when you're working with people who are really going for it and making an effort, when you feel like slacking, you take yourself into consideration. You might need to rest and not make so much effort. But you're usually sort of motivated because you just want to do what's right, and you see other people doing it, you think, yeah, I can do it too, and you feel less of a victim to your circumstances. You think, I can take a bit more responsibility for what I'm doing here, and it's much easier when we're all working on a project together, doing something together. Then it's very, very exciting. It becomes really interesting. It's not without its difficulties. But then it's not all going to be easy. That's why you have to make an effort. If it was easy, it wouldn't be any effort. And that's why in the Tri Ratna Buddhist order, we organise a whole number of things. For instance, we got this building. I tell you, I'm a trustee of this building. Sometimes I wish we didn't have this building. It costs an absolute arm and a leg to keep going, which I'll come back to that, because I might ask you to practice some skillful intention and dip into your wallets later. But We've got this building here because we want people to be able to come somewhere, to meet somewhere, where they can just be together. Be together practicing things like mind training, which is meditation, just trying to open themselves up to the influence of the Buddha, which where we have sort of rituals and ceremonies, quite weird, but, you know, great fun. And we also do things like have what they call car boot sales, and we go on retreat together. It's like we all go on holiday together up to the Peak District for a weekend, usually raining, and we sit around for a few hours doing nothing, just sit on cushions, eyes closed, sitting there waiting. And we're all doing it, you know, for an hour or something like that, and we look around thinking, oh, well, everyone else is doing it, I can make a bit more effort. And it's quite easy, and you think, oh, this is nice sitting here doing, I'm really doing nothing, it's lovely, you know. And, God, you know, no one ever lets me do nothing. I always have to be doing something. And it's really nice just doing nothing. And you have this opportunity to go away with each other. In the past, we've created communities. Some of the people here I know live in communities. We actually live with other Buddhists, and that's what I've done most of my adult life. Live with other Buddhists, living in the same house, cooking for each other, negotiating what colours to paint the walls and things like that, and all the things you do when you live together. But having a sense of a shared experience. And I've even worked in businesses. In fact, the business that I run here, Breathworks, is what I like to call a Buddhist business or a team-based right livelihood business. It's a livelihood that's in accordance with this idea of helping others. So I'm surrounded by Buddhists. I work in this building. I run a business in this building. And up until recently, and actually part of the week I live with Buddhists, I'm surrounded by Buddhists all the time. It's not that hard for me to make an effort, actually. It's quite relatively easy. The hardest thing is views. When I have a view that you don't want to do this, and then say Chandana, like you might have this view that I ought to finish now. Right? And I've got this other view, thinking, oh, I'm just enjoying this. I really like standing here talking to you. And he might be thinking, I'm going to have to get up and say something in a minute. You know, it's going to wind up soon. And I go, I'm not going to go with that view. That might be a complication we would have. Yeah, and that's the sort of thing that, you know, challenges you to move on to a higher level. And I can just say, okay, Chandana, I'll go with your view. I'll stop in a minute. And cause I don't want you to be anxious and things. And or he might just think, oh, I'm really enjoying this. I'll encourage Sonia to go on for another hour. And, you know, people can go if they want. But usually it's views that you get hit by in living together and working together. But it makes you aware of how attached you are to your views, which is good, because if you're not aware of how attached you are to your views, you just get all upset when you have arguments. And if you think, oh, I'm quite attached to this view. Why am I attached to this view? Suppose I wasn't attached to this view, how would it be? And you think, oh, I've got a choice here. I could be attached to this view or not attached to this view. I think I won't be attached to this view. All right, you're right. And you go, well, that was easy. And then you have a nice cup of tea together and everyone's happy, you know, instead of having that theme where you have a big argument and then you don't talk to each other for hours, you know, which is often how things end. Imagine if we sort of expanded outwards and we were just having that effect. If we can keep up this effort, not only would we be changing, but people we come into contact with would notice it. It will have an effect on people. People we work with, people, family, people we live with, friends, they will sort of think, well, she's a bit different, a bit changed. Sometimes I feel threatened by it and they try to make you be who you were because that's who they wanted you to be. But actually, if you go on working with it, if you can encourage one another, you can have this experience of something more, which doesn't happen all the time, but you can experience it for longer and longer periods. Said eventually that you can get into this sort of third level of consciousness as like a stream of emotions, a stream of thoughts, and where everything's easy. The effort becomes sort of effortless. You have to sort of keep doing the things, but you enjoy them. It's like when I said meditating. First, it's sometimes difficult meditating, just watching your mind, and you get distracted, and you watch it a bit more. But other times it's just like you sit there and it's like easy. You're just sitting there, completely content. You don't want to be anywhere else. You don't want to be doing anything else. You're just comfortable not doing anything, completely doing nothing. just sitting there, sort of not even waiting, really, just sitting. It's lovely, absolutely lovely. And you don't have to make any effort when you get into that. It's as though energy sort of just flows and you just continue manufacturing that mental state. Unfortunately, it always seems to end, but then everything changes. So it's possible to get into that stream, but it's also possible to change the world. It is possible to make some changes to the world. Maybe, you know, the fabric of the world's not going to change, but the world is heading for an enormous crisis. I was listening to something called the Ruth Lectures the other day, and it was about finance. I hadn't realised that, I never completely understood why growth was important and how it's based. But I started getting an angle on it. And I've got two daughters and six grandchildren. What I realised was that, and I'm a baby boomer, I'm that generation, I realised that all the benefits I'm having at the moment are going to be paid for by my grandchildren. Growth is about borrowing more and more. What we're doing to the world is giving our society and those that come after us more and more debt. When we say we want the National Health Service, we want the government to provide all the services that we think we should have, what we're saying, really, which we don't know, is that the young are going to pay for it. And the guy that gave the Reef lecture, he said, if only the young knew what the old were doing to them, and when they voted, they changed the government, it would be a very different government. But the problem is, the young don't vote. The baby boomers do. So the baby boomers, like me, we vote in the governments that give us the most benefits. And, you know, we're all right. We're doing a great job about it. But you young people, if you're not voting, you're just going to be lumbered with our debts. We're borrowing on your behalf. We're borrowing with the view that you, and even your children, will pay it all off. It's creating more and more of a crisis. You can see what's happening in Greece and what's happening in Europe, and things aren't looking all that good for the baby boomers. It's not looking good at all for my grandchildren. And the world is global. Whatever we do has a global effect. It's not just happening in one little place. It's happening all around the world. Everyone wants to be rich. Everyone wants to have more and more of everything. You know, sometimes my mind thinks, what happens when we get to the end of more and more? When we run out of things, but someone seems to find something else to, you know, it's one of those questions you can't really ask. But we do seem to be making the world potentially a very unpleasant place for the people that are going to come after. I don't know whether it's absolutely true that we're causing global warming, but it seems reasonable to believe that. I don't hold it as a sort of a view I would die for, I don't think, but it seems a reasonable view to hold. So I take my bottles to the bottle bank, mainly because I view that putting them in landfill is just filling up the earth with lots of bottles, and they could all be crushed and recycled. So I do my bit. But I could do a lot more, and I guess that's why I'm a Buddhist. I just see that practicing Buddhism, and I don't want to sound like a salesman here, but I just want to share with you my enthusiasm. I can see that by transforming my own mind, by working on myself in a more and more skillful way, it will affect other people. I hope by giving a talk like this, it will have an effect on other people. I hope the effect on you, if it has affected you, will have an effect on even more people. And those people will be affected, and the ripple, if you like, will just go on and on. So I think that the Buddha's message is influencing the world. There's a greater thousands of people are interested in mindfulness now. In the health service, it's sort of like the in word. In fact, the latest in word in the National Health Service in psychology is compassion. You can't get more compassionate than Buddhism. It's all about compassion, really. And it's sort of like becoming the in thing. You know, psychology is proving that if you're compassionate, I can finish in a minute, if you're compassionate, you'll be happy. It's all part of well-being. It's all part of even flourishing, the new form of well-being. It's basically there as Buddhism. And it's sort of like, it's as though a message is catching on. And we could be part of that. And if we are part of it, we may start to experience this third level of consciousness. So I hope if you've enjoyed this talk and if you feel inspired, you not only come back to this building, which will only keep going if you happen to give some money when you leave, but you know, please feel very, very free to come back and participate in more talks, in classes, going on retreats, even living together. If people wanted to start communities, you could get some advice from me of the do's and don'ts of communities. And you're very, very welcome. And I think in this way, we would make the Buddha even more and more visible in the world. So let's stop there. Thank you very much.